yes, all right. Get up, Tom. I'm up here. You're not. Get up. He's watching me through thick-lensed binoculars. Hello, everybody. My name is Babs Black, and I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon.
Hi.
Of all the things we imported from California, I think I'm most fond of that. Dear, you say hi. Some days I'm recovering, and some days I'm grateful. And rarely am I both. Well, what are you going to do, you know? I was grateful until I decided that I would make a restroom call prior to our opening this meeting. For all of you that stood in that restroom in that line and refused to let me cut in even though I was the speaker, you're going to be sorry. When Tommy called me and asked if I would come join you, my mother overheard part of the conversation. And when I hung up the phone, she said, "Well, are you going someplace again?" And I said, "Yes. Some fellow called me from California and wants to know if I'm interested in flinging my spring." And my mother assured me that it had been sprung years ago, and it was a waste of good plane fare. Everybody needs a nurturing mother like I have. I was going to give you my wisdom with the steps. I'll tell you, I do a step study that just bring tears to your eyes. God, it's beautiful, it's beautiful. And Levon beat me to it. Then I thought, well, the traditions, I mean, they're not so bad, you know. You can flesh them up a little bit. And then I sat in that morning meeting, and Lord Dean went through the concepts. So that leaves me with nothing but my experience and what strength and hope this program has given me. So I'm afraid you're stuck with that. Tommy, if you and your table want to leave now, it's all right with me. They sent me a note prior to my coming. Speaking of nurturing, I do want to share this with you. Sent me a handwritten note from Hip's table. They counted up how many 60 minutes of theirs that I might waste if I poop around up here and don't have anything reasonable to say, and threatened me with dire consequences. So I hope in 20 minutes they're all sound asleep from boredom. I wish I could tell you that the first alcoholic I ever knew was the one I found myself married to, because I think that makes us look a little swifter. Now, I don't know about your meetings out here, but my God, you go in an Al-Anon meeting in my part of Texas and you say, how many of you are raised in alcoholic homes? And there's a wave of arms, you know. And you want to say, didn't you catch on? And, you know, I'm just like them. I think one of the most destructive aspects of this blessed disease that has brought us all together in this room is that it has an almost overwhelming power to obsess us. God. You know, I had a lot of bad stuff in my life, didn't you? But it seemed to kind of come and go. I would take as much of it as I could, and then I'd say, oh, to hell with it, and I'd push it away. But I was never able to do that with alcoholism until I found Al-Anon. It has the power to obsess me. And I was raised in that kind of a home where somebody else's drinking was my problem. To this day, I don't know if it's anybody else's problem. I really don't. My parents were divorced when I was an infant, and I was originally raised by my grandparents. My grandparents were marvelous. They loved me in the way that I have come to understand every human being has a right to be loved by at least one other human being. And that is, it was truly unconditional. If my grandmother came in the kitchen and caught me in the act, the first thing she'd say is, "All right, which one of you kids put Barbara Ann's hand in that cookie jar?" Because I'm telling you, I was innocent. And if in a rush of honesty, I might confess what I'd done, my grandmother's reply was always the same. "You didn't know what you were doing, Barbara." I loved them very much. The only problem was they were in their 60s and I was 4. And, you know, grandparents kind of start out old. Have you ever noticed that? And I wasn't catching up to them. But up on a hill in that little town in Illinois, there lived a family like we used to read about in the first grade reader. He was a dentist, the only dentist in town, so he had a thriving practice. And he was the mayor and president of the school board. He had a big bushy mustache and a head full of black hair. He had a beautiful, lovely, loving wife who happened to be my mother's only sibling, her sister that was 11 years older. So she was settled, and they had two little girls a little bit older than I was. They had a white dog and a black cat named Smokey Joe. They lived in a two-story house up on that hill that overlooked the Mississippi, and I wanted more than anything in the world to live with them. And one day I got my wish. I guess I was 4 or 5, something like that. I think my grandmother just gave out, and I was allowed to go up there to live, and I lived up there until it came time for me to go to college. And for most of that time, it was just what I thought it would be. It was neat. I was a part of something that was normal and good and important. You know, they were important. And because I was kind of tagging along behind them, I was kind of important too. I was always one of Doc's girls, especially when I'd get in trouble. Was that one of Doc's girls? I think that was one of Doc's girls. You know, and by the time I got home, the phone calls had been made, and my aunt was waiting to have a little chat with me. But I loved it there. And I don't know, I really can't honestly tell you it was alcoholism. The only clues I have are the feelings I have, my reaction to what went on. Whatever it was, by the time I was in high school, all that adoration and that love I had felt for my uncle had flip-flopped, and oh, I hated him. You know that kind of hate you can feel in your throat? And you'd never dare, never dare voice it. Because if you do, that thing in your throat's going to explode and you're probably going to die. And so I never talked to anybody. And that became a way of life to me. Never talk to anybody. Deny it and push it down and it'll go away. By the time I was a junior in high school, my light at the end of the tunnel was to go to college. If I could get out of there and go to college, I'd be okay. I could leave all that behind and I'd be fine. A typical lie we tell ourselves. And so I began to apply to colleges. I chose the one that accepted me and made a deal, a tuition deal, and was the farthest away. I wish I could tell you that I chose the one that was academically sound. But not many young girls growing up in northwestern Illinois dream of someday going to the University of Texas. Hell, I didn't even know they had a university. It was in a town called Austin. Can you imagine naming a place Austin? And they accepted me on one August in 1951. I landed in Austin with my little suitcases and enrolled at the University of Texas. It was my escape. I didn't like it there. I didn't like Texans. What little I knew about them, they talked funny and slow. God almighty, don't they talk slow? You just want to reach in there and yank their old tongues out. You know, my God, say it, man, say it. And they brag. What are they so proud about? You know, they just, oh, I didn't like them. The men wore high heels. And these tight little pants, these little bitty butts, you know. And I just didn't like it there. And then about my second week there, we were forced, literally forced, by this old bag that ran the dormitory, to go to a thing called a freshman reception. Please, give me a break. My God, I was 17 years old. I was far too sophisticated for that kind of junk. I knew what it'd be. And, of course, it was in the gymnasium. It was for all the little freshmen to get to know each other. Oh, and I knew it'd be those little acne-faced boys all against one wall, you know, with their hands in their pockets doing whatever they do. And we're over there wanting to get out of there and, you know. But she played dirty pool. She threatened social probation if we didn't go. So some of my other fellow sophisticates and I trooped off to Gregory Gym. And I was over there at the punch table, getting some of that god-awful taste and stuff, you know, trying to figure out how long I'd have to stay before I could get out of there. And all of a sudden, I turned around and I looked in that room. Now, this is the first time I'd seen that many of us together in one. And I started taking a quick count. Now, I'm not kidding you. There were at least 9 or 10 fellas to every girl in that room. This was 51 and the Korean War was winding down and all these vets were coming home. And they could either work in Daddy's drugstore or take the GI Bill and go to a college. And every last one of them was horny. And I looked around and I thought, you know, this higher education might not be a bad deal after all. For those of you who aren't as old as I, you missed it. Because I'm telling you, in 1951, the only requirement that you be a sex goddess on the campuses of this marvelous country was that you be breathing in and out. I really liked it. I just really, really did. Occasionally we go to class. By the time I was a junior there, I discovered that most of the good ones had been picked off, you know? The ones I was kind of narrowing the field down to, and all of a sudden they weren't there one day. And I found out they ran off the valley and got married or some damn thing. So I realized that I'd been having a lot of fun, but this was getting serious business now. Because I was already a junior in college, and I didn't have anybody on the string. I mean, I had to get busy here. I sure as hell didn't want to get a degree and go out and work. Come on. What kind of a life is that? So I began to look in earnest. And I knew that my time was limited. I mean, I wanted to get married, I wanted to have babies, I wanted to buy a station wagon, I wanted to have a house. Menopause was breathing down my neck. I was, 19? Crying in the mirror. So I kind of made a deal with God. I said, I tell you, you send me anything halfway decent, I'm going to grab it and make something of it. And you know that's exactly what happened. He came as a result of a blind date. You know, I was really terrified that I would marry someone that had a drinking problem. And if I ever made a mistake in my life, that wasn't going to be one of them. I wasn't too interested in how much money they had. I did care how they looked. I'm sorry to tell you that, but I'm old enough now I can admit that at long last. It was very important to me how they looked because, see, the better they looked, the better I looked. And so I wanted something good hanging onto my arm. And here he came, 6'2", good-looking dude. A little bit shy. Oh, wow. It was like a lamb to the slaughter now that I think of it. The date was to a fraternity party. And the strangest thing happened to him when we got there and he began to drink that slop they said, you know, whatever that stuff is they serve. Some magic happened to him. His shyness left. He became quite glib and very clever. He had trouble walking. He was tripping over the flowers in the rug till he had a couple drinks, and all of a sudden he spread a stare. I mean, he's tangoing, and they're not even playing a tango. And I was the envy of every female in that room. I mean, he was neat. And I remember thinking to myself, now this is what booze is supposed to do. Well, he drank them dry, you know, and they took everybody home. It was a Saturday night, and he said to me, I'm going to 6:30 Mass in the morning. Would you like to go with me? Now, see, I never put that stipulation on God. I said, just send me something decent. Never in my wildest dreams that I think I get a Catholic. Well, now, think about those, see, I mean, especially a Catholic that knew how to drink. Of course, I didn't know that that was a redundant idea at the time. But if I had a Catholic that knew how to drink, I'd never have to worry about alcoholism, and the bastard could never divorce me. I mean, what more? Well, it's all I wanted in life, I'll tell you that. And we indeed went to that Mass. And I was far more impressed with him than I had been the night before. Afterwards, we went to brunch. And he confided in me that back in his altar boy days, he'd always really wanted to be a priest till they explained to him what celibacy was. Wow, I've got a horny, almost priest on my hands. I mean, oh, his fate was sealed from that moment on. I think to this day, the poor fool thinks that he pursued me, but that was not the case at all. He was the best thing that happened to me in a long time, and I wasn't about to let him go, and I didn't. And one Saturday morning, about a year and a half later, at St. Anne's Cathedral in Houston, we took our eternal vows. I walked in that cathedral in my swishy white dress, and I was engaged. And I walked out, and I was married. I mean, with a capital M. I was Mrs. Black. Now, I don't know where in hell he was for that hour and a half. Because it was obvious to me as soon as we walked out that he did not have the picture. He acted as if he were the same. And I remember saying to him early on, stop that, I said. There's people watching. Take your hand off that. We're married. See, married people don't do that sort of thing. Married people don't have fun, for example. You know, married life is very serious. Very serious. Oh, my God, you've got savings accounts to start. You got to start those, getting that money together, buy that station wagon and all that. And he just went on as before. I mean, it was as if he was unconscious during that thing. Didn't he realize what had happened to us? And I remember I used to follow him around that little apartment, and I'd say, I'm your wife. And he'd say, I'll drink to that. And he would. And then one day it came to me. I knew what the problem was. There were just the two of us. Well, it really wasn't that different, was it? But if we had a family, ha, 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 that would bring out the best in him, wouldn't it? So I got pregnant. No big deal. Later I found not getting pregnant. Now, that was a big deal. And I gave birth to a little girl. We didn't have that partnership foolishness that they have today. I tell you, when you're laying there on that labor, on that delivery table, I love what Carol Burnett says, you know, take your top lip and pull it up over your head. That's about it. I don't think Daddy Dear says, oh, the pain is unbearable. I can hardly stand it, doctor. Hell no, he tells dirty jokes with the doctor while you're laying there dying. Anyway, I was in there all by myself, me and this idiot doctor. Gave birth to this little girl. And I knew this would change things, and I was indeed right. It did. My life has not been the same since. But it soon became apparent that I had had a child. We didn't. He just went on his merry way. I remember he said to me quite earnestly one time when I thrust the baby at him, you know, I used to do that. Go to Daddy, this screaming kid, you know. And he didn't want to hold her, and she didn't want to be there. And she'd scream louder, and he'd say, when she's older and we can do things together, Then I'll spend some time with her. I said, finally, after about the fifth time, I said, about how old is that? He said, about 19. And then I knew what it was. We only had one child. You can ignore one. So I had another one. Then I had another one. You know that interpretation of the second step, doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results. I tell you, that labor and delivery suite to me was like a revolving door. I'd wake up in the morning sometimes with this belly. And so help me, I couldn't remember if I just had one or I was fixing to. It was crazy. It was insane. It was insane. Eventually we got transferred to San Antonio. My mother had hoped it was something in the water there in Houston, and I hadn't mentioned to her that I was pregnant again. By now, I'm trying to hide it, you know. She was saying cute things like, you know, Babs, I'll bet the government would do something about somebody like you if you asked them to. So that's San Antonio, and I'm a little bit pregnant, and finally got a lot pregnant, and found a doctor in a phone book, and went to see him, and he said, I'd like to take some pictures, and he did, and then he sat me down, and he said, well, Ms. Black, I think there are four, possibly only three. And I said, babies? And he said, yes. And to share honestly with you the way I felt then, I was pissed. I don't know how else to describe it. I had been a damn good sport up to now. No, no, I really had. I had these little babies, you know, and I'd go to the Safeway and somebody would say with pity in their eyes, are they yours? And I'd pull myself up and very proudly say, yes, and every one of them was planned. I think that's big of me to do that. I really wanted to fall into that stranger's arms and cry my eyes out and say, my God, can you get me out of this mess, lady? But see, I never said that. And now this joker tells me they're coming in litters, and I don't think that's funny. Anyway, I left his office, and you know Mother Nature does strange things to people like me. In that short trip it took me to drive home, my mind began to work, you know, and I started thinking, shoot, if he thinks there's four, there might be five. Well, now, wait a minute. If you got five, the government builds a wing on the house. They send them all to college. Gerber sends all the food and all that. The tour bus from Sacramento comes up, and everybody wants to see where the Quints live, you know. God, we'd be on Edward R. Murrow and Life magazine. And by the time I got home, I thought I had the biggest news in the world. Of course, Father Guillen was babysitting. I could tell the kids were locked out there in the backyard. And I went in to tell him. Now, I don't know what I expected him to say, but I didn't expect what I got. I went in and he'd had a few beers. You know, he needed to kind of steady himself when he had charge of the children. They did make him nervous. And he had just that edge off, you know, that kind. And this was my first experience with instant sobriety. I'm sure all of you have seen that, you know, when the state policeman pulls you over. And anyway, I walked in, and, you know, he's just a little fuzzy. And he said, well, honey, what'd the doctor say? And I said, well, he said there are four, possibly only three. And he looked me, I mean sober, yeah. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, my God, Babs, what have you done to me now? And I felt guilty. I felt guilty. There weren't four or three, there were only two. Very, very small. They were born 2 months premature, and that meant that when we brought the twins home, we had five children, and the oldest had not yet celebrated her fourth birthday. Yes, I know. Oh, my God. And I found that I was running a little ding-dong school there. My husband, in the meantime, had gotten a traveling job. So he left before dawn on Monday and came home very late on Friday. And I began to have a meaningful relationship with Captain Kangaroo. A true resentment really set in. And I'm sure none of you in this room are guilty, but it seemed no matter what neighborhood we lived in, there was always some slattern that lived a few doors down, whose one or two little children would get on her nerves about 10 o'clock every morning. And so she would say to them, "Why don't you go on up and play at the block? She'll never know you're there." And they did. I mean, I couldn't have told you which were mine and which weren't. I was 38 years old before I could go to the bathroom all by myself. Because for years I had held conferences. I mean, none of those kids would look at me twice, and they just had a sixth sense, and one of them I know would say to the other, "I think she's going in the bathroom." As soon as I got comfortably seated, in they come. My kids, your kids. They want to know where clouds come from. Why is the grass green? You know, I still get kind of a nauseous feeling when I remember those years. It was about this time that we sent Kathy off to preschool. Now, she wasn't old enough. She was only 4. But I lied. I never thought I'd have the guts to lie to a nun, but I would have lied to the Pope. I stood right there in front of that nun, and I had my hand over Kathy's mouth, because unfortunately she knew how old she was. And I said, "Oh, yes, sister, her birth certificate is in the mail." Sent Kathy off to nursery school. The only thing she brought home from that preschool was pinworms. Now, I know we shouldn't talk about this after lunch, but life is full of little nasty sidelights, and those of you who call yourself parents and are not familiar with pinworms, I question whether you have a right to even carry a card. Nun called me and told me they're all over the school, and she told me how to find them. That's another meeting all in its own. So every night I'd watch Jack Parr, and then we'd have the jets peel, and I'd salute, and then I'd get my flashlight and put it between my teeth, and I go looking. I have to do it when the kid's sound asleep. If you wake up the child, see, it's not going to work. So I became an expert. You real easy pull that little sheet down from their little knees, and you peel those little knees apart. And you shine the light. And then you get low and run out of the room. To this day, my daughters sleep with 4 pair of underwear on and their legs tied in a knot. What does that mean? Angela?
Angela Breen.
Angela Breen. Is she in here? B-R-E-E-N. If you know her, she has a message. Call the hotel operator. At any rate, one night I found one. Oh, God, I was so excited. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I called the pediatrician, rousted that sucker out of bed. I said, "It's right here on my finger. What'd I do?" He said, "Don't get excited. Go back to bed. In the morning, you go to the drugstore and you get a bottle of the red medicine. I'll order it." Now, this day, I do not know the generic name of the red medicine, but it has to be one of the most potent concoctions known to man. I can still get my 24-year-old youngest son, Timothy, to mow the grass by just explaining that I unearthed a bottle of the red medicine in a box somewhere. And I mean, that mower's going like that. I got it, and I brought it home, and you gave him so many teaspoons for so many pounds of weight, you know? Vicious, vile, red-looking stuff it was. And I pumped it down to kids, and, you know, I mean, no big deal. I don't know why people got so excited about these little parasites. Hell, there's nothing to them. And I Lysoled everything in the house, and in the morning we had potty time, and the kids were so excited, and I nearly had a stroke. It was rather, it was Technicolor is what it was, and I called the pediatrician and I said, something terrible's happened. He said, oh, I should have mentioned that. The red medicine, it seems, loses none of its color on the way through, but don't worry, it'll go away, fine. Couple weeks, they're gnashing their teeth and squiggling around, and shoot, we got them again. I called him back. He said, how much of that stuff did you take? I said, I don't go to that nursery school. No, he said, everybody's got to take some medicine. So I drank a couple quarts. I don't know how much it was. No big deal. I'm a big girl. Downed her down. And in the morning, we all had our little Technicolor time, and no problem. In 3 or 4 weeks, we got them again. And this time, he said those words I so dreaded to hear. How much did you give your husband? I said, well, see, this is the sort of thing I discuss with my husband. If he knew the kids were wormy, they'd have to go back. And I said, besides, my husband travels. He's hardly ever here. He said, yes, and he's probably spreading worms all over South Texas. You're going to have to dose him up, Miss Black. Well, you know, my way was clear. Poor fool. When he got in that Friday night, I had the kids all in their rooms playing. They'd been fed. I have steaks on the grill. I said to him, can I fix you a drink before dinner? And I hadn't said that in some time. And he said, well, don't mind if I do. Thank God he was drinking a thing called Rusty Nails back then. Do you know what that is? That's drambuie and take the enamel right off your teeth. And so I fixed him a rusty nail, a little unlike one he'd ever had before. It had, I don't know, maybe a teaspoon of the red medicine in it, you know. And we did the steaks, and I said and did all the things I was supposed to, and I keep pumping those rusty nails to him. By the time it's about 10 o'clock, I mean, he is feeling no pain. By now, he's getting a lot of red medicine in each drink and just a touch of rusty nail. Because I had a lot I had to get down to him. I can still remember, as if it were yesterday, him sitting on that couch, and I'm picking up dishes, and he said, honey, are you coming to bed soon? And I said, any minute. And then he smiled and said, I sure do love you, and his teeth were bright red. But I knew I'd done what I needed to do. We would never again be visited by the worms. In the morning, I was making coffee, and a blood-curdling yell came from the bathroom. I rushed in there, and there he stood stark naked and just white as a sheet. And he looked at me with hollow eyes and said, my God, Beth, I'm bleeding to death. You know, I had not had his attention in easily 2 years. I tried all sorts of ways to get this man to listen to me. And I could never get through that wall they put up, you know. And here he was, mine for the taking. So I did what any Al-Anon in training would do. I looked down at the evidence and I shook my head sadly and I said, I told you what would happen if you didn't stop drinking like that. And I tell you, if terror would get him sober, he would have never had another drink. As it was, it lasted about 3 weeks. You know, and then he had just a little one, and then just a little one, and in no time we're back where we were before. Our life went on. We had another child and eventually ended up in Dallas. And there was nothing left anymore. Most of you in this room, whether you're alcoholic or Al-Anon, you have been there. You have been there. Where there's nothing left anymore. Something had happened to me that I'd never heard of before. And I first heard about it after I'd been in Al-Anon 6 or 7 months, and my God, I was so relieved. Because I thought it was my own special brand of madness. Somewhere in those years, I had begun to freeze over and shut down. I was never ever hurt in the same way twice. As soon as a nerve was stepped on, man, I pinched it off. And it's very effective. It does indeed handle the pain in life. The problem is you can't be selective about what you're going to feel. And although I felt no pain anymore and no loneliness, I also didn't feel joy. Life to me was something that I would have to endure until the end came. I knew that the best years were over. And besides, I wasn't so young, was I? What more could I expect out of life? After all, I was 32, 33 years old. And that's the sort of shape I was in when we got to Dallas. I don't know what happened. God, if I did, I'd go into business. I don't know. I do know that I called a lawyer to file suit for divorce, but Lord, I'd done that before. This was a little different, and this one wanted money up front. See, they'd done business with me before. But I called my mom. She said she'd send me the money. No problem. I don't know what happened. I can only assume that my husband, in his illness, got sick and tired of being sick and tired. I wish I could tell you that it was because I filed suit for divorce. Makes me sound powerful, doesn't it? But I know indeed that had nothing to do with it. And that Monday, he went to talk to a man about his drinking and agreed to go to an AA meeting that Monday night. The man called me and asked me if I would take him to the meeting. And of course I explained to him that I didn't drink. He said, I didn't think you did. Of course not. I quit years before to show him you could have a good time without that stuff. You know how much fun I was, don't you? And then the man said the magic words. I need you to take him, Mrs. Black. I'm afraid if you don't take him, he may not go. Well, I need you? Man, that is music to my ears. I said, give me that address again, buddy. He'll be there. He came home. I helped him dress. Somewhere in those years, I had become keeper of the fly. I don't know why I did that. I mean, it isn't the sort of job that you see in the classified ads and you apply for. It's just that my husband's mind seemed to have slipped. And almost always when he would use the restroom, he would forget to zip his pants. And so it became my responsibility, no matter where we were, to as inobtrusively as possible zip him. And I did that. I never asked for thanks or gratitude. It was just part of my responsibility. And I remember getting off that elevator that night to go into that AA meeting, and I checked him over, of course. And of course, you know, what can you expect? And so I zipped him up, and in we went. Big room, about as big as this. A couple hundred people in there, very nicely dressed. I couldn't wait for them to let the alcoholics in. I figured we'd set them maybe in a little circle in the middle of the floor, and then all of us volunteers or whatever we were, we'd stand on the outside. And then I figured they'd ask him questions. And, of course, the drunks would lie. You know how they are. And then those of us that knew them would explain what the truth was. So help me God, that's what I thought I was there for. About 5 minutes and eight, an ugly, ugly woman. She was ugly on October the 4th of 1970, and she remains ugly to this day. Walked up to me and said, pardon me, my dear, are you an alcoholic? She might as well have accused me of being syphilitic. My God. I had dressed very carefully for this meeting. I had on my aqua maternity pedal pushers. Well, I wasn't pregnant, but they were so comfortable. My little white maternity over blouse, my little aqua Japanese thong sandals. I had those in every color. I had my miraculous medal hanging out on that, like a headlight on the front of that blouse. I had my campfire leader's pin up here. I mean, I thought I'd covered all the bases, and this idiot woman asked me if I'm an alcoholic. My God, couldn't she tell by looking? And so, of course, I answered. I said, good Lord, no. And she said, then you'll have to leave. This is a closed meeting. Oh. And I wanted to say, wait a minute, what do you mean? I mean, see, nobody explained the rules to me. Ask me if I'm a giraffe, I'll say I'm a giraffe. I don't care what happens. What do you mean I have to leave? My God, do you know how long I've waited for this woman? I have waited to see him humiliated, and you're telling me I can't stay and watch? I mean, I have a right to this. And while that's going around in my head and I'm trying to get out of my mouth, they very expertly ushered me right out the door. I mean, you know that business about whenever anyone anywhere reaches, don't you believe it? I reached my very first AA meeting and I was taken out. And they put me in a little stinky room with some very sick people. I had never heard of Al-Anon, nor did I care. What it had to do with me? Nothing. I mean, if these people wanted to stay married to those jerks, that was their problem. But I knew what I was doing, man. I was getting out. And so I had to sit there for an hour because I had the car keys. I listened that night to the second speaker. I don't know what the first one said. I have no idea. She was an Al-Anon. She had nothing to do with me. But the second one, he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now we're getting down to it. Here was a font of knowledge up there. And he began to talk about what it's like to be an alcoholic. I'd lived in it all my life. And I didn't have the slightest idea what it must be like. So obsessed was I with how I felt. It never occurred to me to try to imagine how an alcoholic might feel. He did a beautiful, beautiful job. I don't know how long it had been since I'd cried. A long, long time. But I sat and listened to him and I cried. He said if my husband had never laid eyes on me, he would this day be an alcoholic. Oh, my God. Could that be true? I mean, I didn't think I caused all of it. I mean, see, you didn't know his mother. But I know between the two of us, we had done him good. And now he's saying that's not true. He talked about recovery. Recovery? You mean just not drinking anymore? There's more than that. He described the blessed recovery in AA. And he started a fire in me that I have to this day. They gave me a priceless gift that night. Hope. Where there had been none. We walked out of that meeting and they had cautioned me not to question him about what happened. But, you know, one little remark wouldn't hurt, would it? And so I said rather nonchalantly, as if we've just been to the museum, well, how'd it go? And he looked at me very soberly and said, I think, Babs, if I'm able to do what they say, maybe someday I can like just a little part of myself. I had never ever felt that way about myself. And I came to believe that night that my husband had never felt any other way. As I said, that was October the 4th of 1970. He hit the AA ground running. Oh, my God. You know how he was at 3 months. Some of you were that way at 3 months. I wouldn't live with a 3-month sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous if my life depended on it again. Somewhere he caught the Holy Ghost. Oh. And he brought God home to the wife and kiddies. God was the answer to everything. Plus, whatever member of AA he had last been with, that's who he became. So when he came home, I never knew if he was going to be Roy Rogers. And while I'm busy trying to get my Dale Evans outfit on, he becomes, you know, Billy Graham, for God's sake. He was trying all these personas on till one felt comfortable, and I'm going bananas, bananas. Going to Al-Anon meetings, our two oldest children were teenagers, and they were forced against their will into Alateen. They were forced to go to 6 meetings. My sponsor explained to me that if my children were constipated, I did not ask them if they wanted an enema, and that alcoholism had allowed them to become spiritually constipated. And Alateen was the name of the enema, and whether they wanted it or not, they were going to take 6 doses. Thank God, by the 5th dose it took, And they got just as gung-ho as their father. It was a little sickening around there for a while. I'm going to Al-Anon meetings and I'm really not hearing, you see, because it really doesn't apply to me. But he's looking better and better. God, he's zipping his own fly. He's paying bills. He's going to work. He's saying things like, forgive me, I was wrong. First time he said that, I thought I'd have a stroke. He's pleasant to be around. And you know, he's looking better. Isn't it amazing how they clean up so good? And then I opened my eyes one Friday night at an open AA meeting, and I noticed how many good-looking broads they've got over there. Have you ever noticed that? If those are alcoholics, I'm an aviator. Come on. You can't look like that and be alcoholic. And he's surrounded with them. And then these women are coming up to me after the meeting and saying, he is just darling, Beth. Suddenly it occurred to me, what if I throw this guy out in a dumpster and one of these bleach blondes picks him up? I didn't like that idea. So I called the lawyer and said, just put it off. I'll get in touch with you. Don't call me, I'll call you. Decided I'd sit back and see what's going to take place here. And I'll tell you what took place. He began to change. My only teen children began to change. You know, they get so full of love, you can get diabetes if you stand next to them during the time. Younger sister would wear the skirt to school, you know, and get caught. And the older one that owned the Alateen that owned the skirt would say, before the program, I would have beat the crap out of you. But now I know you just envy me and you want to be just like me and I love you. And the little one would look at me and say, it's weird, Mom. It's weird. I said, yes, I know. Finally, my husband and my two oldest children kind of went off without me. They were talking together, and I don't know what they were talking about, and I felt abandoned. I felt betrayed. And I went to my sponsor, and so help me, that's the first time I ever heard anybody say that I understood. Why don't you try those steps? You know, we didn't used to say the steps adapted from Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad we stuck that in there. Because they were always identified as AA's 12 steps. And I always thought they were up there on the wall so I'd know the buzzwords. You know, so I'd know what they're doing in there. Kind of like the Rebecca Lodge or something. So help me, I didn't understand that I was supposed to be using him in my life. And my sponsor suggested that I might try that. I'd really got hung up on this compulsion and obsession, you know. I thought that was the biggest cop-out in the world. That's one drunk's excusing another's behavior. Well, you know, I got this compulsion. Well, you know, I'm obsessed. And I wanted to string them up by their thumbs, you know. So one night, I mouthed off in a meeting about how I thought that was a big line. That Friday night, I was at an AA open meeting, sitting next to my sponsor, and I'm on the aisle, as I usually was. And I noticed a little man came in. He had some sort of flyer from a neighboring group, and he laid it up on the podium for them to make an announcement. And as he turned around, I realized that this poor fella did not have a keeper of his fly. Now, I hadn't checked flies in, I don't know, 9, 10 months, I guess. But it's something that you kind of never lose the knack for. And so I'm talking to my sponsor, and just as he drew abreast of me, I deftly reached over, and with one hand I grabbed his crotch, and with the other hand I zipped him up. And just as my fingers touched his belt buckle, we both realized what I'd done. And I looked up into the two of the most terror-filled eyes I hope I ever see. The man was absolutely petrified. And I quick let go of his crotch, and I mean he hooked him out those doors on a run. I truly believe if there's a God in heaven, one night I'll be in an open AA meeting, and a little man will stand up and say, you know, back in 1970, I was going to go have a drink, and this woman grabbed my crotch. You may be in that meeting and I'm not. Please let me know if he shows up. At any rate, as I sat there, I was absolutely horrified at my own behavior. My sponsor laid her hand lovingly on mine and said, "Tell me, Babs, could you qualify that as an obsession?" And I'm here to assure you that the program does indeed work. I religiously asked God to remove it, and it was removed. If you sit here this afternoon with your fly open, it's your problem. Not mine. Things went along as they would, as you would expect them to. I began to use these steps in my life until they became second nature, thank God. I was able to make amends to my mother and to my children. LaVon rang a bell in me when she talked Friday night. Something about 2 to 3 years sober. Watch yourself, ladies. My husband got 2 to 3 years sober, and somehow the vengeance of repentance was on him, and damned if he didn't invite his parents to come live with us. And they did it. He and I are both only children. And Dad built a garage apartment above our garage, and he and the Wicked Witch of the West moved in up there. And like Lamont, I nearly went crazy. I had long since stopped talking about the alcoholic in the meetings, but man, I had plenty to say about her. I remember my sponsor said to me one time, "Why don't you ask for God's help, Babs? The greatest weapon my mother-in-law had against me was her mouth." And it was a particularly low time. They had been living there, I don't know, 8 or 9 months, maybe. And I wasn't doing very well. And I said, "God, I've got to have help." Now, I'm not saying this is why this happened. I don't know. But it certainly brought home to me that I need to be very careful about what I ask God for. I said, "God, I need your help. You've got to shut her up." And that night in her sleep, apparently she suffered a stroke. From that day till the day she died, she was mute. And you know, the strangest thing happened to me. I began to see her differently. She was now disarmed, you see. And I began to see her differently. I began that day to make my amends to her. I know she got increasingly worse, and Dad was terrified that she'd have to go to a nursing home. Visiting nurses would come every other day to bathe her. And I watched them one day. They'd strip her, and she'd lay naked on that bed, and then they'd vigorously scrub her, and then they'd dry her, and then they'd dress her. And my father-in-law, who was the quintessential Victorian man, stood over in the corner with his eyes averted. I remember thinking to myself, "Dad, I'll bet you've never seen her naked before, have you?" And I realized how painful it was for him. And would have been doubly painful for her if she knew what was happening. And so there it was, the ideal opportunity. I said to the nurses, "I don't think we'll need you anymore." And from that day until the day she died, Dad and I bathed her every other day, and we did it a piece at a time. And each time I did that, I was filling the cup that I had helped empty in my ignorance. I could never have done that without this program. I would never have understood the freedom in that without what I heard around the table. Our children did extremely well in Allity, and it soon got to be the thing to do, the rite of passage, to be old enough to come into Allity. I watched my children change and grow. They were more mature at 16 than I was at 35. There was only one thing that I had failed to do because it was never time. I had come to understand in listening to meetings that the only real requirement I have in any relationship that I have is that I be honest. I'd heard that, and I believed it, and I understood it. I used it with my children. I used it with my mother. I used it with my father-in-law. I used it with other Al-Anons. But it was never time to use it with my husband. It's very dangerous, you know. Honesty is a very potent thing. very, very powerful. And you need to be very careful about using it loosely. And so in my rationalization, his sobriety was never of the quality that it was time. And you know what happened. Nothing, literally nothing. If there's nothing to fertilize and help a relationship grow, it dies. It dies from lack of nourishment. It dies from, who knows, I don't know. All I know is that one Sunday afternoon when we had been religiously attending meetings and he had been sober for 8 years, I was working at the Allen Information Center by now. All our children were involved in LIT. And one Sunday afternoon he told me he wanted a divorce. And I thought I would die. And typically I said, no, that's not what you mean. No. What we need now is we need some counseling. And he kept standing there with his feet spread and said, I want a divorce, Babs. That's what I want, is a divorce. I called in the troops, you know, everybody who'd ever sponsored him, put out the call, come talk sense to this man. And he was determined. He indeed wanted a divorce. And I didn't think I could survive that. And I would have told you prior to that that I had such a grasp on this program. My God, it had saved my life so many times. I was so certain that God loved me just as I was, that I was indeed safe in God's hands. And he said that, and it all went out the window. I have come to some many realizations since that day. One of the things I have discovered is that God is as big as your need. And I didn't have much of a need before then. I mean, AA really, really had brought order to our lives and prosperity. And when he left, my need was gigantic. And I had to find something fast. And I did. It began on early morning walks. I was so angry with him. There were still three children at home, and I'd walk around and around that house and say all those things I needed to say to him, but he wasn't there to hear. And I'd wake the kids up. So a gal I'd start talking to, she worked all night, and I'd call her about 2 in the morning, just crazy. She said to me, why don't you go outside and do it? So I began walking. I walked to this day. And I went out there, and I told him. I mean, I told him. I'll tell you, and another thing I'd say. And by the time I'm on the way back home, you know, I'm talking top of my voice. There are still women in my neighborhood that when they see me out, they bring their children in and close the doors. I must have been a sight to see. And, you know, I also learned, I learned some of this. But one day, I mean, it was really bad. We've been to the lawyer, and he's just explained that whether I like it or not, he's going to clean my plow. Period. You know how they are. And you know how we are. You know. Now, my father-in-law and mother-in-law lived with me. They didn't want to move to that apartment either. And Dad said, and my father-in-law was also an attorney. Uh-huh. And Dad said, don't worry about this, Babs. I'll take care of it. And indeed he did. And my husband just done his little thing again, you know. And And I'm doing that walk, and I remember saying to heaven, well, I'll tell you one damn thing, it can't get much worse. And with that, apparently a Great Dane or a St. Bernard had preceded me. Honey, I stepped in that and skidded about 20 feet. I had on new sweatpants and brand new shoes. And I was covered in that stuff. And I just sat there and laughed. I said, okay. I didn't mean to tell you how to run your business. Believe me, friends, it can always get worse. In April, we were divorced. And by April 15th, I had to have a job. The information center is not a job. I know you say we may employ special workers and all that stuff, but they don't really employ you. And I had to find a job. There was an Al-Anon that worked at a hospital in Dallas, and she kept bugging me to come over and interview. There's nothing I could do. I'd never worked. What am I going to do? What are my recommendations? That I'm a hell of a good Al-Anon? Come on. So finally, to shut her up, I went. And I was right. I don't type. When am I good? I can file, maybe. She says to me, says to her friend there, does a management engineer have a research assistant yet? She says, no, the last one just quit. See, she should have told me something. They brought him in. He's in worse shape than I am. He has trouble talking. And we were there for an interview. And I waited and waited, and he just kind of dug his... So I interviewed him. I mean, somebody had to. He was an industrial engineer. I said, what does an industrial engineer do in a hospital? Well, he says, mainly I go into various departments, and I watch people do work they've been doing for, 15 or 20 years. I watch them for 15 or 20 minutes, and I tell them how to do it better. I said, you're not going to understand this, son, but I've been going to meetings for a little over 8 years trying to learn how to stop doing that, and you tell me there's a career in it. And then he said those magic words, I need you. I said, God, I know you do. I went home and I called Dad upstairs and I said, well, Dad, I got a job. And he wasn't surprised. He said, of course you did. He said, where? I said, at Presbyterian Hospital. Oh, he said, it's a good hospital. How much are they paying? We never talked about that. All he said was, I need you. What more do I need? That was in 1978. And today I'm a senior management analyst at Presbyterian Hospital. And if I get mad and quit, they're going to have to close that place down. My mother-in-law died shortly after that divorce, blissfully unaware of whatever had happened. And Dad asked if he could stay. And I said, of course. He and I were beautifully interdependent for the rest of the time he lived, which was about another 10 years. Dad died when he was 87. He became the oldest volunteer at Presbyterian Hospital. He would go in with me 2 days a week on Mondays and Thursdays. Dad worked in the outpatient oncology clinic. He wore his little red volunteer's vest and his white Reeboks. And he wore a white toupee that was always a little askew. Dad was blind. He was ever on the lookout for the rich widow who needed help with her portfolio. And if you asked him what he did there, he would say without a glimmer of a smile that he was there to help the old people out of their cars. What a beautiful, beautiful man Dad was. And then one day, about a year and a half ago, he died. He was 88, as I said. And I depended enormously on him. Not only emotionally, you see, my father-in-law loved me the same way my grandparents did. He was never, ever surprised when good fortune came to me. He just was surprised it took so long. I remember the first time they gave me a new title, a little more important one. And Dad said they were about 11 months late. I never had to prove anything to him. It became apparent sometime in here that my mother could no longer live alone, so she moved in with us. And Mother and I lived downstairs, and Dad lived in the garage apartment. And she got increasingly worse. One day she called me at work and said, Babs, I've looked all over and I can't find our cat, and we didn't have a cat. And I called upstairs and I said, Dad, Mom's looking for a cat downstairs. He said, my God, have you got a cat? I said, no. He said, oh. I'll take care of it. And see, I knew he would. And I got home that afternoon. He was still downstairs helping her look for the cat. And I needed him. I just needed him. And then he died. And what am I going to do? My mother has Alzheimer's, apparently, because you know how they diagnose, well, they diagnose Alzheimer's from a corpse, you know, on an autopsy. We're not willing to go that far. I'm not that curious. But I have a long list of things she doesn't have. You know, as you rule all those out, that's what you're left with. And she's looking for cats again, and we can't afford to have someone come in and stay with her. And I don't think she would survive in a nursing home setting. And I said, God, I need help. There's a little Spanish woman about 5 years older than I. Her name is Maria. Maria, I believe when she was born, was doing about 65 miles an hour, and she hasn't slowed down. She talks in about 12 decibels. Everything is important right now. Buenas dias! And she is so full of life. And Maria didn't like where she was living. And she heard about the apartment. She approached me at a meeting. And that was last May, coming up on one anniversary. God, we've survived Maria almost a year. I'll tell you, it was such an emotional shock to my mother to have Maria. Hello, Lord! She screamed, you know. I'm here with you this weekend because Maria is there. Because Maria is there. Maria teaches Spanish. What else? And she's in and out all day, just like Dad used to be. And I still work at Presbyterian Hospital trying to keep their head above water, and it's a thankless task. And I know that my mom is okay when Maria is there. A day at a time, these three old broads are making it. I would have told you that 20 years ago, by far the best was over, and it was okay. I was a pretty good sport about that, too. Little did I know. Thank God that we don't really know what's in store for us. I have known more joy and more pain in the 20 years since my first Al-Anon meeting than I thought one life could ever hold. One of my joys was Winnie Eddy. I met Winnie 15, 16 years ago when I was really taking myself very seriously. When Winnie heard my husband had walked out, she called me and said, well, the old boy finally wised up, huh? I've been crying for 3 days. And Winnie said, well, he finally wised up. And I said, well, hell, he never was big on brains. And suddenly it wasn't. So indeed, God's gift to us. And I'll miss her. As will many, many people in the fellowship. I want to thank you so much for making me feel welcome ever since I got here Friday. If you find yourself by some quirk of fate abandoned in Dallas and you need a meeting, my group is called the Addison Group. Call me. AA or Al-Anon, I'll take you. I think they got an AA meeting next door. I don't know too much about them. I can't vouch for them. But I'm telling you, the Al-Anon group is first rate. And if you want to come with me to a really first-class Al-Anon meeting, I know that they will make you feel as welcome as you have made me feel here this weekend. Thank you very, very much for including me in your fling. My name is Babs Black, and I am a grateful, recovering Al-Anon. Thank you.